You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Film historian Christina Rice joins us now. Her forthcoming biography of Jane Russell is one of the most anticipated books of the year. Her first book, a great work of film scholarship, is called Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. Christina Rice, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
If you were going to choose a stage name, why would you choose a stage name that nobody will ever pronounce correctly for the rest of your life?
Isn't that, you know, I think if I were to ever meet Anne, I have a few questions for her, and I think that might be one of them. why did you pick that name?
When I was a kid and I saw her name in the credits, I just assumed it was Anne Dvorak.
And that's,
I'm sure what everybody would.
I mean, I feel like it can be whatever you want it to be. I always call her Anne Dvorak. I always have. So I know there's a quote out in the world that appeared in like a book of quotations, her saying it's Dvorak, but like you mentioned, it was a stage name. And I don't even think she knew how she wanted it pronounced for a while. So, you know, she first adopted it when she was a chorus girl at MGM, and you see publicity back then and it's spelled Dvorak, so which is very clearly Dvorak. And then when she signed her contract with Howard Hughes, it was spelled it D apostrophe and then Dvorak. So she might have wanted it Dvorak. I don't know if anybody actually ever called her that. And Dvorak was always the common pronunciation.
Is there any film of her saying her own name?
I don't think there is. I have a radio program, though, where somebody is interviewing her and calls her Dvorak, and she doesn't correct them. So I always kind of took that as, you know,
Mentioned that she did a lot of radio plays. So when the announcers announced her name, did they call her Dvorak or Dvorak?
It was Dvorak. It was Dvorak. You know, and early on when I discovered her, I wasn't sure how to pronounce it. And Robert Osborne on TCM pronounced it Dvorak. And so that's when I decided, okay, if that's what Osborne's going with, then that's what I'm going to go with.
He's the man.
Yeah. But we usually just refer to her as Anne D. My house. That's what, Anne or Anne D.
And that's what her mother called her, right?
Yeah, her mother referred to her. Like when she would talk about her in letters, she would refer to her as Anne D, correct?
Well, Christina Rice, how did you get interested? To me, I love your book, by the way. And one of the things I love about the book is the story of you writing the book, which is kind of in the foreword and afterword. But tell us, how did you get interested in this story?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was a very personal odyssey that, you know, occurred over, you know, a 15-year period. And, you know, I originally discovered her when I was in college in the mid-90s. I checked out a copy of Three on a Match from my local library, and it was part of that Forbidden Hollywood series that Leonard Maltin had done the introductions for. And you know, it sounded tawdry and fun, and it was only an hour long. And, you know, I was busy and in college. I thought, well, I can take a break for an hour and watch Humphrey Bogart and Betty Davis. And there was Anne. And that movie is wild. It is a wild, just one of the most memorable pre-codes. And I've never been so blown away by a performance. And so I tried to find more about her at the time. This is the mid-90s, so the internet's there, but it's not a source of information the way it is now. Didn't find much and kind of put her on the back burner. And a couple of years later, I was doing an internship, and I had majored in film. So I was doing an internship at a talent agency. And the person who I reported to was just an incredible, like just a film buff, the likes of, you know, like I knew my way around like the big classic movies, but you know, he was one of these people that you could show him 3 seconds of a movie and he would tell you what the studio is, even if it wasn't a movie, which I like to think I could do now, but certainly, you know, 20 years ago, I couldn't. And in my desperate attempt to impress him, I said, oh, well, you know who I really like, and I just can't find anything on is Anne Dvorak. And that impressed him like the way I wanted it to. And it just ended up really like cementing our friendship. You know, all these years later, he's still a close friend, but you know, he went home. He's a movie memorabilia collector, specifically on Norma Shearer. And anybody who collects memorabilia long enough has a giant stack of things they don't collect on, but you've just ended up with. And he had a photo from Three on a Match and he brought it in and gave it to me. And that's when I discovered I could afford to collect memorabilia. And I'm a crazed collector. And back then, we still had a bunch of movie memorabilia shops around Hollywood. So I started collecting on her. We went to the Margaret Herrick Library, which is the Academy's research library. And there was a folder full of information about her. And I decided then, if nobody's going to write her story, then maybe I should be the one to do it. And you know, it was very naive at the time because I didn't know what the hell I was doing and how to research, and the book didn't come out for, you know, like another 15 years, but that launched the odyssey.
So you wrote the book you wanted to read.
Absolutely. 100% wrote the book I wanted to read. Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes you have to do that. And you picked an interesting person to write about, for sure. And I think I have, of course, seen 300 Match, but the movie that really impacted me with her was Scarface, where she plays Paul Muni's sister in a kind of a weird brother-sister relationship. But before we get to that, you mentioned the pre-code thing, and I'm not sure all of my listeners know exactly what you mean. So talk a little bit about, if you would, the production code and the effect it had on Hollywood and when it came in and so on.
Yeah. So the production code, you know, was developed as a response to content in film. So once we get like into the 1920s and we have the jazz age and people are kind of turning their back on the Victorian era, you know, people are becoming more modern, and that's reflected in motion pictures. And then there are groups, there are, you know, religious groups and social groups who object to the type of content. And you have the real life scandals like Roscoe Arbuckle and Norman Desmond Taylor, you know, all of these real life scandals. And it's like, oh, those Hollywood people are just evil and they're going to corrupt us all. And so it starts to look like the government might regulate the film industry, and the film industry decides to regulate itself. And so that's where they launched the Hays office, William Hays, and a production code is established. So it's a list of the don'ts and be careful. So don't show this, don't show that, you know, these people must be punished. You can't show people sharing a bed, all of this type of thing. And it's established.
Well, what were some of those things? You couldn't show people sharing a bed.
You couldn't, I think you weren't supposed to show like drug use. You weren't supposed to, you know, women should be relatively covered up. You know, bad deeds should be punished by the end of the movie. You know, you shouldn't reward bad deeds. So yeah, it was just a whole list of things that shouldn't appear on film.
And of course, no cursing and no nudity.
Oh, no cursing, no nudity, none of that. I think no open mouth kissing, I think, is one of the things are growing up as a kid.
I think they had like a timer on how long you could kiss.
I think so. It was a whole, yeah, just all of these things that were just going to corrupt society. So this list was established. And, you know, when the era of sound pictures comes in, filmmakers pretty much just ignore it. And so you have this era, it's called the pre-code era, which is an interesting, you know, title for it. So it's this era where the code, the production code exists, but everybody ignores it. And it's kind of roughly, I think, 1929 to like roughly the first half of 1934. And it's just a fun period of motion picture filmmaking, because all of those things you aren't supposed to have, you still do. You don't really have like the cursing and nudity, although you have maybe in some cases it slipped through. But, you know, it's just this period where, you know, and it's also the depression, and, you know, the world is pretty grim. And so I think these movies tend to be a very grim, you know, kind of realistic look at the world, which is why I think they're so fascinating. But finally, you know, it gets to be too much, and the Legion of Decency is formed through the Catholic Church, and the pressure actually starts coming down hard enough, and people are, you know, being told it's a mortal sin to go see these movies, and it starts to hit the bottom line. And then the production code is actually enforced starting in 1934. And then, you know, what happens, I think, for somebody like Anne, who certainly worked, you know, she worked until 1951. So she made movies after the production code. Her most potent performances, I do think, such as Scarface and Three on a Match, you know, do come in that era. And after the code is enforced, those movies aren't re-released. So, because you can't, you would have to edit so, like Three on a Match, it's only 63 minutes long. If you edit everything out of it, it'd be like a 5-minute movie. So I think her movies are just really inaccessible for a very long time. And she retires early enough that I think that's one of the reasons why by the time I discovered her, she'd become fairly obscure.
So it adversely affected her career in the sense that Scarface and some of her other great performances weren't seen for decades.
For decades, yeah. I mean, in the case of Scarface, you know, you're also going up against the eccentricities of Howard Hughes, who pulled it out of distribution, you know, and it wasn't seen, because I think except for on the underground market until I think 79.
What was Anne Vorak's interaction with Howard Hughes?
Yeah, it wasn't a whole lot. So, you know, she was discovered by Howard Hawks. So she was really good friends with Karen Morley, who she had met on the MGM lot when Anne was a chorus girl. And she had been trying to break out of the chorus and get better roles. And like Joan Crawford had tried to help her out, and, you know, along with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. And nothing was really clicking for her. And Karen Morley had been cast in Scarface. And according to Morley, she had been offered either role. So there's the two female roles. There's Cheska, who's the younger sister, and then there's Poppy, who's the girlfriend. She chose Poppy, even though Cheska she thought was a better role, but she thought it was a really good role for Anne. And so there was Howard Hawks hosted a party for the cast. They were still looking for Cheska, but he had already cast George Raft and Paul Muni. And Morley called up Anne and said, "Get over here." And so Anne, you know, went over to Hawks's house and zeroed in on George Raft, who's her main love interest in the movie, pulled him on the dance floor and definitely caught Howard Hawks's eye. So she was cast, but, you know, Hughes, you know, certainly had an eye for talent. You know, he had already signed, you know, Jean Harlow, and, you know, later on would sign Jane Russell to a long-term contract. And so he signed Anne, and she had a little bit of contact. The research, you know, that I did indicates like he did try to take her out on the town, and she was like terrified to go out with him because she was 19 years old, you know, and on screen in Scarface, like she is striking. She is so I don't think she ever looks quite that striking on film again, just that the hair and makeup and costumes that she has, and just her performance is electrifying. And that person she was on screen wasn't who she was in real life. So she was terrified to go out with Howard Hughes, where he would find out she was actually kind of boring and he wouldn't want to, you know, keep her under contract. And so I have this like wonderful quote from her mother saying that, you know, Howard Hughes was calling her house and she was like sitting in the corner eating a ham sandwich with cold cream on her face, telling him, you know, tell him, no, I'm out on the town already. you know, and then, you know, ultimately he does, you know, he sells her contract to Warner Brothers at a profit for $40,000, which I always like to point out that he sold Jean Harlow's contract to MGM for $30,000 and yeah. Anne's for $40,000. So like once upon a time, Anne was a hotter commodity than Jean Harlow for a brief period of time. And once that happens, you know, and she badmouths him in the press for selling her contract, and, you know, he badmouths her back. And that was pretty much the end of her relationship or association with Howard Hughes.
If Anne Vorak had died young, perhaps she would be more well remembered, instead of living into obscurity.
I think that's entirely possible. Like, yeah, certain people. Yeah, I've always thought, you know, because even somebody like Montgomery Clift, who I do think is well known, he's not as well known as James Dean, even though I think they were contemporaries, because, you know, Dean really went down in that blaze of glory at a young age. And, you know, Montgomery Clift, you know, didn't die young enough.
Not that Anne lived to be a very old. She was fairly young by my standards when she died.
Now 68 sounds, 68 seemed old when I first discovered Anne, you know, 25 years ago. And now it's like, oh, she was so young. She's very young.
Of course, everybody from that era died around that same age. I think 68 was how old Joan Crawford was when she died, if I'm not mistaken.
Was she really? Yeah. But they also, you know, she smoked and drank like the rest of them. Yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with film historian Christina Rice, author of a forthcoming biography of Jane Russell and a book called Anne Vorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel.
It's interesting when you look at her filmography, she appeared in virtually every Hollywood genre. There's not a single genre I can think of that she didn't make a picture in.
Maybe not like science fiction.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Maybe. I don't think she did science fiction, but yeah, she certainly did. Yeah, she did the dramas, and she did the Westerns, and she did like Blind Alley is kind of a like pre-noir. I think like Secret of Convict Lake is kind of like a Western noir. And she did comedies, and, you know, she did one kind of screwballish comedy, She's No Lady, which, you know, isn't particularly great. She did musicals. So yeah, she had range. Anne had range. Absolutely.
I had just recently seen A Life of Her Own, the George Cukor film, which is it's got a very strange mood, that movie. And Anne is really great in it.
And I think, I feel very confident saying like that's the movie she definitely deserved an Academy Award nomination for, at least. You know, she's not in it very long, but I think she is what really stands out from that film. I have a hard time watching it once she's no longer there. Yeah. I think I've only gotten through it maybe twice.
But it's a strange movie, the way it's shot. It's really kind of, it's kind of a noirish kind of melodrama, but it's a weird movie.
It's a very weird movie, but I think it just, you know, I think Anne had a lot of incredible raw talent, but when she worked with those really strong directors like Cukor and Hawks was just when she absolutely shined.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, Christina Rice, the detective work that you had to do. I mean, how were you able to view, it seems like you've seen all of her films except for the ones that don't exist anymore. And how did you find them all? I mean, I can't find them.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, and
even Flight of the Barbary Coast was kind of hard to come by.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I mean, and I was doing, you know, most of this research like in the 2000s. So, you know, a lot of her films are available now. So I think like Olive Films finally put out Flame, and then there's the Warner Archive. But it was a lot of it was this like underground like network of film collectors. So a lot of the films I watched were like 10th generation VHS copies, like taped off of like TNT and WGN. In the 90s. So, you know, in watching films that are poor quality, like really dilutes your ability to enjoy the film. So one of my favorite films of Anne's is The Private Affairs of Bellamy with George Sanders. And when I first saw it, like the copy was so bad, I thought the movie was terrible. And then a few years later, I got a better copy and I'm like, oh, this is actually really good. So
there's a Blu-ray on it.
What? There is. There's a Blu-ray on it now. Yeah, it's incredible how many of her movies are available. So, yeah, it was primarily that, just kind of, you know, talking to people and, oh, so-and-so has a copy of this and I'll send it to you. The most difficult movie to find, I think even now, is She's No Lady, which she made at Paramount in 1937. The only copy I'm aware of is a nitrate print that the UCLA Film and Television Archive has. And at this point, I don't even know if they do, if they allow viewings of their nitrate prints anymore. But at the time, I was in grad school. I was getting my library degree. And so that was excuse enough for them to agree to let me watch it. And so I had to go to this facility.
Is it 3,500?
Yeah, it was a 35 millimeter nitrate print that I had to go to a facility in Hollywood and watch on a flatbed, you know, with somebody had to sit there with me, probably to make sure it didn't, you know, blow up. And so this point, and so my friend, the Norma Shearer collector, my friend Darren, who has been on this odyssey with me, he, you know, came and watched it with me. And it, you know, it's certainly not her best performance. And once the film was done, we just kind of turned around and looked at the guy behind us, and he just kind of glaze-eyed looked at us and said, oh, that's something I never would have seen if it hadn't been for you people. Sorry. So I was able to see that movie and one of her MGM shorts as a chorus girl, the Snappy Caballero, was also at UCLA. And miraculously, she made three movies in England during the war. And two of them, as you'd mentioned, are now considered lost. They're two RKO films, Squadron Leader X and Escape to Danger. She also made a movie called There's a Future in It, which was a short that was made for the Ministry of Information.
Is that the one with Barry Morris in it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah. And that does survive. And it was put out on this DVD compilation of these films. So, you know, and I had to get it and get a region-free player because it only came out in England. But yeah, so I was able to view that film, which is something I never thought I would.
What did Barry Morris look like? Barry Morris, listeners, played Lieutenant Philip Gerard in The Fugitive and was also a regular on Space 1999 and was bald. Was he bald? Yeah. Was he bald when he made that movie?
I haven't watched it for a long time. I don't believe he was. I think everyone looked pretty tired though, as they're like making this film, like in England during the Blitz. Anne looks very tired.
And Flame of the Barbary Coast, she's with Duke, with John Wayne.
She is. And, you know, and I was actually able to, I connected, you know, this is, you know, again, when I was in library school, I was able to connect with somebody who worked in the preservation department at Paramount. And he was just this incredibly generous man who actually they had just restored that movie. And so I got to go to a screening room at Paramount and he screened it for me. This incredible print. So it was, this book took such a long time to research that, you know, I just very kind of gradually developed a lot of connections I think just from sheer length of time that I developed the reputation as, oh, it's that Anne Dvorak woman who's doing the book. And so I don't know if I'd ever be able to replicate this experience with somebody else.
Let's go back to Scarface for a minute. When people hear the movie title Scarface, they immediately think of Al Pacino chewing up the scenery in what I think is a terrible remake of a great movie. And I think of Howard Hawks's film, which is, I think it's one of the greats of all time. And Boris Karloff is in it. He's so great. There's a scene in which Karloff is bowling with his friends and he bowls his bowling ball down the alley. And at that moment, the enemy gang comes in and machine guns them all to death. But the camera, unlike Brian De Palma's camera, the camera of Howard Hawks, follows the bowling ball down the alley and it's a strike. All the pins go down.
Yeah.
But the guy who threw the ball is no longer alive by that moment. I mean, and that's a chilling, to me, that violence off screen is way more effective because it's not fake.
No, I think that movie, even all these years later, I mean, we're, you know, gosh, closing in on almost 90 years later, I think that movie is still so chilling. Absolutely.
And, you know, her part, her relationship with her brother, that's a weird movie for relationship.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's super uncomfortable, you know, and there, even though this is that pre-code era where the code isn't being strictly enforced, Howard Hughes still had to battle the censors on it because they took exception. They took exception to the violence of the film and the glamorization, the perceived glamorization of the gangsters. Didn't really take note of this clearly incestuous relationship.
That wasn't one of the things they were.
No, not at all. Which I think is so strange because it's so overt. Yeah, that's all right. It's so clear and so uncomfortable and so creepy. But,
I mean, if you watch just a couple of scenes and you don't know their brother and sister, I mean, they absolutely seem like they're lovers.
That he seems like a completely jealous lover. Absolutely. And they just play off of each other so well. And what I will always be astounded by is it is her first film. So it's not her first time, you know, she was with MGM, you know, as a chorus girl. So she was comfortable.
She made about 100 films before that one, but that was.
Yeah. She made countless films and was clearly like very comfortable in front of a camera. That's her first time really acting. And she's, you know, she's 19 when she gets signed to that. So 19, nothing, almost 20. So she's probably like 20 when she makes like that.
To your knowledge. He was nothing like that character.
Oh, and no, not at all. Not at all. And I think was much more low key than that, but sure played that high wire really, really well. But again, I think that it's also a huge testimony to Howard Hawks, though. I think he could, you know, he's probably my favorite director, and what he could bring out of his performers is, just incredible. Just a marvelous director.
Really, yeah, absolutely great. You found all these movies that she was a chorus girl in, and you seem to be really good at picking her out of the chorus.
Yeah, once you once you get to know her and what she looked like, and again, she looks very different when she's in the chorus because she's like a goofy teenager. She's, you know, 17, 18 years old, but she really stands out. When you're watching the actual films, I mean, she's the one like flailing her arms the most and smiling the biggest. Like she's really buying into it, and she's really, you know, she's really trying to make her mark. And so, yeah, so I have, but you know, a lot of people in my sphere can do it as well. And one of my favorite stories is, you know, years and years ago, I went up to Hearst Castle with my friend Darren, my Anne Dvorak pal, and my mom. And so we were watching this IMAX movie that's like a history of William Randolph Hearst. And so at one point they flash a photo taken on the MGM lot because Marion Davies, you know, was under contract there. And it's a group of chorus girls sitting on the roof of a, like a Hearst newspaper car, and Anne's one of them. And so it flashes on the screen for, you know, like a microsecond, and Darren and I both gasp, and I turn to him and I go, "Is that?" And my mom just goes, "Yeah, that was Anne." So even my mom can pick Anne up out of the chorus. So yeah, it's become, it's kind of a fun pastime to pick Anne. And since the book came out, you know, I have found a couple more films that she is in at MGM that I don't have listed in the book.
Is she a good singer? Is she a good dancer?
The dancing, I mean, I think the style of dancing at that time, you know, like those early musicals, I think everybody looks a little bit awkward. Like if you watch like Joan Crawford in Dancing Lady, when she does her great dance routine, you know, and I think Anne was a dance instructor at MGM. So, you know, her dancing is serviceable.
Joan Crawford was known as a great dancer, but she's very heavy footed.
I think Anne was too. So Anne is serviceable as a dancer. I think she's fine. She could, you know, she could do a time step, and her singing is fine. Like she has a low voice. She has a, you know, it's not the strongest voice, but it certainly is a pleasant voice. And, you know, some movie like Flame of Barbary Coast, you know, she sings in, I think Abilene Town, she sings in, but then in like Thanks a Million, she was dubbed. So, but I think her voice was fine. She could certainly carry a tune.
Thanks a Million. That's with Fred Allen, who I love.
Fred Allen. Yeah. And Dick Powell and Patsy Kelly.
Yeah, that's a really good movie. I like it a lot. So she made some missteps in her career, but as your title of your book, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel, indicates, I mean, she was really a person who tried to battle the studio system, the contract system. Tell us a little bit about her battle.
Yeah, so she did try to battle the system, I think, poorly. You know, I think she didn't go about it particularly well. And I do think a lot of it was driven by the men in her life. So, you know, so she goes to Warner Brothers and starts making movies with them. And Warner Brothers seemed like they were positioning her, you know, as one of their marquee players, although who knows, you know, some like they would star you in a film and then, you know, you'd be fifth billed in the next, but they, you know, they put her in some, you know, they star her opposite, you know, James Cagney and The Crowd Roars, and she's, you know, the star of The Strange Love of Molly Louvain, and she does Three on a Match. But on The Strange Love of Molly Louvain, she falls in love with her co-star Leslie Fenton, who's 10 years older than her, and they get married within weeks. And Fenton was somebody who had a great deal of contempt for the studio system and for Hollywood in general, but liked the fact he could, you know, make a few movies, make some money, and then go to Europe. Like that was kind of, you know, it was a way to finance his wanderlust. So he never signed long-term contracts with studios. And after he marries Anne, it doesn't bother him that she is under contract. Doesn't bother him that Warner Brothers has just shelled out $40,000 for her to Howard Hughes, you know, just as, you know, 1932, as the studios are starting to get hit by the Depression. And so he convinces her to walk out on her contract so they can go on an 8-month European honeymoon. You know, and I think she's also, you know, again, she's only like 20 years old. She suddenly finds herself, you know, her name splashed across newspapers and she's getting recognized on the street. So I think it's, you know, a combination of exhaustion because Warner Brothers worked their actors to death. So she's exhausted. I think she's kind of overwhelmed. She's young and dealing with this, you know, newfound fame. And so she walks out. So not only does she walk out on her contract, she badmouths the studio on the way out. So calling, you know, Warner Brothers slave drivers and or producers or slave drivers, and Howard Hawks sold her up the river. And I do think a lot of that was fueled by her husband and by her agent at the time, Charles Feldman. And she hadn't, you know, even though she's getting a lot of press, she's not necessarily proven herself as good box office yet, because her movies just haven't really, you know, a lot of them haven't come out. But she goes to Europe and it's an incredible experience. She's gone for 8 months. I think it's one of the highest points of her life. And she comes back and Warner Brothers takes her back. And so that's one of the inaccuracies I see floating around the internet a lot, is that she went on this honeymoon and then served out her contract on suspension, which is absolutely not true. So she comes back in 33. They make her sit it out for a while, and then she makes a ton of movies between 1933 and, you know, the end of 1935. She has some kind of illness, which I'm not really sure. You know, she loses a ton of weight, and I was never able to figure out exactly what happened. There were some rumors she had tuberculosis, which she did suffer from later on. Whatever's going on with her, she's sick enough that she's collapsing on set and can't work. And so Warner Brothers suspends her, which, you know, according to the contract, they are within their right to do. So they do suspend her, and she says, you know, she wants to come back. They won't let her until she goes to one of their studio doctors. It's just a standstill. She files a case against them in, I think, late 1935 to get out of her contract, saying that she was suspended unlawfully. And, you know, it goes to court. So, you know, she faces off in court against Warner Brothers. You know, ultimately, she does lose. You know, they have to pay her some money for this period of suspension. She does lose, and, you know, they keep her on contract for a little bit longer, and then they go ahead and release her early. They made their point. They were done with her. But she did file this court case before James Cagney, because James Cagney and Betty Davis, you know, who do have box office clout, they both take Warner Brothers to court in 1936. Yeah. Cagney is successful. Betty Davis isn't successful legally, but I think ends up like earning the respect of Jack Warner and just goes on to have, you know, such an incredible career. But Anne did it first. And, you know, I don't know for sure that Cagney saw what Anne did and said, okay, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to do this. And, you know, and I have more marquee than she does. I can do this too. I don't know for sure that happened, but I at least want to give her credit that she took that plunge before both of them did, even though it wasn't successful.
And she might have, had she been more mature or had better guidance, she might have been successful.
I think so. And I do draw a lot of parallels between her and Betty Davis, because I think they had a lot of similar qualities. And even though their acting styles, I think, are very different, they were very well suited for the same types of roles. They both started at the same time. And I think, you know, Betty Davis is the example of, you know, fighting the studio correctly. So, you know, Betty, I don't think would have ever walked out on her contract the way Anne did in 32. Like, Betty was so focused. And I think Anne, you know, thought she really wanted a film career and did. But the second she falls in love, she really comes under the guidance of her husband very quickly. And Betty, I don't think, would have ever done that. Betty waited until she had, you know, until she was a box office name and had the Academy Award before she launches her attack. So I think it is interesting to parallel the two of them, to see the you know, the effective way to fight the studio and the not so effective way to do it.
And Betty Davis never had, was never, I don't think she was ever successfully married, and she never fell in love and got all involved with men ruling her life. She made more of her own decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I think Betty wanted to be married and wanted to be in love, but, you know, nobody was going to tell Betty how to run her career.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting today with film historian Christina Rice, author of Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel.
When you're writing about Anne Dvorak, or whichever you want to say, Do you get like mad at her or
Oh,
disappointed in her?
yes. Oh my gosh, yes. Writing is it's just an exercise in frustration. Like, Anne, why are you doing this? But it is interesting, kind of. I feel like my relationship with her husband, Leslie Fenton, was also very complicated and really evolved over the years. Initially I hated him. I absolutely hated him. I blamed him for the lack of success in her career. And that, but when I first discovered this, I'm like in my early 20s. And then, during the course of researching Anne and writing this book, I graduated from, I graduated from college. I graduated from grad school. I started a career. I got married. I had a kid. I bought a house. I survived cancer. Like, all of this stuff happens while I'm working on this book. And so my attitude towards him, certainly softened as I was going through all of these life experiences. And, also my understanding of why Anne did what she did. I think she was horribly misled, but I became more sympathetic. But yeah, I'm still frustrated because I think she was such an incredible actress. She had so much talent, and I don't, most of her movies, are not great. Scarface, certainly. Like Three on a Match is, it's like, I don't know if I'd call it a great movie. Like, it's a hell of a movie. It's a fun movie, but it's not the same caliber as, Scarface. It's not the caliber of some of the movies Bette Davis did. It's not Dark Victory, and it's not All About Eve. And I feel like Anne was usually able to take, these mediocre roles and inject a lot of life into them. And I think she often does a lot with a little, but I still don't think, other than Scarface and, like A Life of Her Own, I don't know that we ever really saw what she was completely capable of. I think we were certainly robbed of what she could have achieved as an actress, had she focused on it and had she gotten better roles.
Well, Christina Rice, you did find that Anne Dvorak did some fabulous work on television and radio.
She did. She did a little. She didn't do a whole lot. She did a little bit, and again, like her, the television appearances are a little bit hard to come by. UCLA has a couple. And then she did some, gosh, I haven't even thought about like the radio work for a while. And yeah, somewhere I have those files, and I have reel-to-reel tapes of her radio performances. So yeah, I think she could work in any medium. And she did one thing. It was something called Broadway Television Theater. And it was almost like this experimental thing where it would be like a pared down, Broadway play that would be broadcast live every single night for a week. So if you couldn't make it to the quote unquote theater in your living room on one night, you could just come the next night. And they did it live. And so Anne did the trial of Mary Dugan.
Cool.
And I don't, this is really early on, and I don't think this was something that ever actually got recorded. So it's not anything I got to see, but I did speak with somebody who actually went to one of the actual, performances and saw it and said she was just so absolutely riveting in it. So, and that was on the small screen. So I think Anne and she did, some of these anthology shows on television. I wish she would have done more. Like, I absolutely, like, I think she could have done a part like Endora in Bewitched. Not to take anything away from Agnes Moorehead, who's
Yeah.
freaking amazing, but I think Anne could have done those types of like character roles. I think she would have just eaten it up and been fabulous.
But by that time, she had stopped acting. And one of the things I like about your book is that you have unanswered questions, and that's kind of brave to say, yeah, I don't know, when you're writing a book. But so, to the best of your knowledge, why did she stop acting when she still had many years of life left?
Yeah, I think so. Anne, the reoccurring theme of Anne is that when she's not in a relationship, she's going to attack her career and just be whole hog and focus on it. And then she gets married again and stops focusing on it as much. And she was married 3 times. Her last husband, Nick Wade, once she marries him in 51, and you know, she does, I think, one more television appearance in 52 and then it's over. And it is a little bit of a mystery because, you know, he definitely had a stranglehold on her and definitely influenced her. He was also somebody who didn't seem to like to work a whole lot and seemed to like to spend money. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that he would want her to stop working.
Yeah, he'd want her to become rich.
So yeah. Exactly. So I don't really understand where that could, it seems like he would have wanted her to work. I do get the impression that maybe by that time she was just done, that she was just, you know, she was just tired. They did, you know, her and Nicholas Wade did launch a, they tried to launch like a production company and they were working on, you know, and Anne, you know, I've heard a few people describe her as an intellectual. So even though she didn't have a formal education beyond high school, I think she did have a marvelous mind and she was always trying to expand her mind. And so she did try to make, they were trying to do like a documentary television series just about everyday people in America. So she did have, you know, projects that never got off the ground. So I think she still wanted to be involved in the entertainment industry, but I think she wanted to do it in a way that was a little bit more creatively fulfilling for her. But, you know, her husband just mismanaged their finances and their business enterprises so horribly that it all just kind of fell apart. So I feel like, you know, I think she probably could have, you know, and she always wanted to be a writer. Like being a writer was something she wanted from a very young age. So
I know that you talk about her writing a history of the world, but she wanted to write nonfiction or fiction. Which was it?
You know, I think it might have been a little bit of both. I know she wrote a lot of poetry. She supposedly wrote like a short play about her parents. Her parents had been vaudevillians, and then her father was a film director and her mom was a film actress. I do think she leaned more towards nonfiction, though. You know, she was a war correspondent, so she was in England during the war because Leslie Fenton was British and he had enlisted in the Royal Navy, and she followed him there. So she did write some articles for like newspapers, and there was a publication called Illustrated Magazine in England. And when she got back, even for some of the movie magazines, she wrote some articles about her experiences. So, but yes. And then in the 60s, she did write, I think it was an 18 volume abridged history of the world that she called Historical Digest, and then recorded herself reading it, and then aimed to market it to universities as a teaching aid. But nobody who she sent it to understood what it was. So I like to think she was very much ahead of her time in the fields of audiobooks and audio learning.
The end of Anne Dvorak's life, there was terrible tabloid stories about how she was a drunkard living in squalor and so forth. And you found that those were exaggerated?
I really think they do. I mean, in the book, I present what I have found and the reader can decide for themselves, because there, you know, there was an article in the National Enquirer that came out after she died. And, you know, there are people who are just so adamant that, you know, it was terrible. It wasn't as good as it should have been, you know, considering, you know, that once upon a time, you know, in the 1930s, she was an actress making like $2,500 a week, which was substantial. She certainly should have been better off. So, you know, she lived modestly, but, you know, I you know, pulled her, you know, estate records after she died, and, you know, she wasn't homeless. Like she had money in the bank. Like her estate ultimately paid for the hospital bills, which something about that I liked, that in the end, like she was self-sufficient. You know, she really did take care of herself. She had Social Security. She had her SAG pension. So she had means to survive. She had a modest apartment. You know, I have photos of her apartment. And again, no, it's not great, but, you know, somebody said that she just had like one, you know, bald light bulb hanging from the ceiling. And like, I have photos of her apartment where there's lamps, like there's a lamp with a shade and it's turned on. So she had more than just one like naked light bulb. And she had, you know, Anne had a tremendous green thumb, and her apartment, you know, was full of plants. You can see in the background, like Anne, she still had all of her plants. So, you know, she had things of comfort around her. Was it palatial? No. You know, was it as good as it should have been? No. Did she have regrets at how her career and how things had transpired? Absolutely. But I don't think it was all like completely doom and gloom. You know, it wasn't it wasn't fantastic, but I think everything with the Inquirer, you know, and those types of publications are like a kernel of truth that's then, you know, turned into something that's going to sell copies.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what they do. Well, the book is called alternately Ann Dvorak or Ann Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. And I think Ann Dvorak would be honored that you brought her to life in such a beautiful way in this book, Christina Rice. And I want to thank you. And I want to ask you one more question, which is, I'm dying for your Jane Russell book. And will you come back and visit us again when that book is published?
Oh, I am more than happy to come back and talk about Jane because she is equally fascinating. Yes.
Well, thank you for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.